Chapter 30. Comfortable looking form encased in a well-brushed suit of black would give you a better idea of his real character than a column of our poor description could convey. Nicholas is rather out of his element now. He cannot see the kitchen as he used to in the old house. There, one window of his glass case opened into the room, and then, for the edification and behoof of more juvenile questioners, he would stand for an hour together, answering deferential questions about Sheridan, and Percival, and Castlery, and heaven knows who beside, with manifest delight, always inserting a Mr. before every commoner's name. Nicholas, like all men of his age and standing, has a great idea of the degeneracy of the times. He seldom expresses any political opinions, but we managed to ascertain, just before the passing of the Reform Bill, that Nicholas was a thorough reformer. What was our astonishment, to discover shortly after the meeting of the first Reformed Parliament, that he was a most inveterate and decided Tory. It was very odd. Some men change their opinions from necessity, others from expediency, others from inspiration. But that Nicholas should undergo any change in any respect was an event we had never contemplated, and should have considered impossible. His strong opinion against the clause which empowered the metropolitan districts to return members to Parliament too was perfectly unaccountable. We discovered the secret at last. The metropolitan members always dined at home. The rascals. As for giving additional members to Ireland, it was even worse, decidedly unconstitutional. Why, sir, an Irish member would go up there and eat more dinner than three English members put together. He took no wine, drank table beer by the half gallon, and went home to Manchester Buildings, or Millbank Street, for his whiskey and water. And what was the consequence? Why, the concern lost, sir, by his patronage. A queer old fellow is Nicholas, and as completely a part of the building as the house itself. We wonder he ever left the old place, and fully expected to see in the papers, the morning after the fire, a pathetic account of an old gentleman in black, of decent appearance, who was seen at one of the upper windows, when the flames were at their height, and declared his resolute intention of falling with the floor. He must have been got out by force. However, he was got out. Here he is again, looking as he always does, as if he had been in a bandbox ever since the last session. There he is, at his old post every night, just as we have described him. And, as characters are scarce, and faithful servants scarcer, long may he be there, say we. Now, when you have taken your seat in the kitchen, and duly noticed the large fire and roasting jack at one end of the room, the little table for washing glasses and draining jugs at the other, the clock over the window opposite St. Margaret's Church, the deal tables, and wax candles, the damask tablecloths and bare floor, the plate and china on the tables, and the gridiron on the fire, and a few other anomalies peculiar to the place, we will point out to your notice two or three of the people present, whose station or absurdities render them the most worthy of remark. It is 12:30, and as the division is not expected for an hour or two, a few members are lounging away the time here in preference to standing at the bar of the house, or sleeping in one of the side galleries. That singularly awkward and ungainly looking man, in the brownish white hat, with the straggling black trousers which reach about halfway down the leg of his boots, who is leaning against the meat screen, apparently deluding himself into the belief that he is thinking about something, is a splendid sample of a member of the House of Commons concentrating in his own person the wisdom of a constituency. Observe the wig, of a dark hue but indescribable color, for if it be naturally brown, it has acquired a black tint by long service, and if it be naturally black, the same cause has imparted to it a tinge of rusty brown. And remark how very materially the great blinker-like spectacles assist the expression of that most intelligent face. Seriously speaking, did you ever see a countenance so expressive of the most hopeless extreme of heavy dullness, or behold a form so strangely put together? He is no great speaker. But when he does address the house, the effect is absolutely irresistible. The small gentleman with the sharp nose, who has just saluted him, is a member of parliament, an ex-alderman, and a sort of amateur fireman. He, and the celebrated fireman's dog, were observed to be remarkably active at the conflagration of the two houses of parliament. They both ran up and down, and in and out, getting under people's feet, and into everybody's way, fully impressed with the belief that they were doing a great deal of good, and barking tremendously. The dog went quietly back to his kennel with the engine, but the gentleman kept up such an incessant noise for some weeks after the occurrence, that he became a positive nuisance. As no more parliamentary fires have occurred, however, and as he has consequently had no more opportunities of writing to the newspapers to relate how, by way of preserving pictures, he cut them out of their frames, and performed other great national services, he has gradually relapsed into his old state of calmness. That female in black, not the one whom the Lord's Day Bill Baronet has just chucked under the chin, the shorter of the two is Jane, the Hebe of Bellamy's. Jane is as great a character as Nicholas, in her way. Her leading features are a thorough contempt for the great majority of her visitors. Her predominant quality, love of admiration, as you cannot fail to observe, if you mark the glee with which she listens to something the young member near her mutters somewhat unintelligibly in her ear, for his speech is rather thick from some cause or other, and how playfully she digs the handle of a fork into the arm with which he detains her, by way of reply. Jane is no bad hand at repartees, and showers them about with a degree of liberality and total absence of reserve or constraint, which occasionally excites no small amazement in the minds of strangers. She cuts jokes with Nicholas too, but looks up to him with a great deal of respect. The immovable stolidity with which Nicholas receives the aforesaid jokes, and looks on, at certain pastoral friskings and rompings, Jane's only recreations, and they are very innocent too, which occasionally take place in the passage, is not the least amusing part of his character. The two persons who are seated at the table in the corner, at the farther end of the room, have been constant guests here, for many years past, and one of them has feasted within these walls, many a time, with the most brilliant characters of a brilliant period. He has gone up to the other house since then. The greater part of his boon companions have shared Yorick's fate, and his visits to Bellamy's are comparatively few. If he really be eating his supper now, at what hour can he possibly have dined? A second solid mass of rump steak has disappeared, and he eat the first in 4 minutes and 3 quarters, by the clock over the window. Was there ever such a personification of Falstaff? Mark the air with which he gloats over that Stilton, as he removes the napkin which has been placed beneath his chin, to catch the superfluous gravy of the steak, and with what gusto he imbibes the porter which has been fetched, expressly for him, in the pewter pot. Listen to the hoarse sound of that voice, kept down as it is by layers of solids, and deep draughts of rich wine, and tell us, if you ever saw such a perfect picture of a regular gourmand, and whether he is not exactly the man whom you would pitch upon as having been the partner of Sheridan's parliamentary carouses, the volunteer driver of the hackney coach that took him home, and the involuntary upsetter of the whole party? What an amusing contrast between his voice and appearance, and that of the spare, squeaking old man, who sits at the same table, and who, elevating a little cracked bantam sort of voice to its highest pitch, invokes damnation upon his own eyes, or somebody else's at the commencement of every sentence he utters. The captain, apostrophe as they call him, is a very old frequenter of Bellamy's, much addicted to stopping after the house is up,
an inexpiable crime in Jane's eyes,
and a complete walking reservoir of spirits and water. The old peer, rather, the old man, for his peerage is of comparatively recent date, has a huge tumbler of hot punch brought him, and the other damns and drinks, and drinks and damns, and smokes. Members arrive every moment in a great bustle to report that the Chancellor of the Exchequer's up, apostrophe and to get glasses of brandy and water to sustain them during the division. People who have ordered supper, countermand it, and prepare to go downstairs, when suddenly a bell is heard to ring with tremendous violence, and a cry of Divi Sion. Apostrophe apostrophe is heard in the passage. This is enough. Away rush the members pell-mell. The room is cleared in an instant. The noise rapidly dies away. You hear the creaking of the last boot on the last stair, and are left alone with the Leviathan of rump steaks. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.